Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the session number 4 of Wisdom from Sutra Passages. For today's discussion, we have selected Bhaya Bhairava Sutta, translated Discourse on Fear and Terror. This sutra is from the Majjhima Nikaya, because Majjhima Nikaya sutras are way longer than the Anguttara Nikaya sutras. However, there was no way that I include the important paragraph, organize them onto one page. So I thought instead organize all the facts in the point form. So there are 7 points here. Now, because the entire sutra is very important, you may have touched on some of the facts here in our previous sessions, not in this series though. Now, first of all, let's look at the, and even though you got corresponding canonical, Pali canonical terms in parentheses, we are not going to touch on them. They are just for your reference. Now, first let's look at the definition of Bhaya, that is fear, and Bhairava, that is terror. Fear and terror. There are different definitions of fear and terror, but the most accepted English definition of fear and terror are: fear is the feeling that a person experiences when a threat is sensed or perceived. Fear readies the body, both psychologically and physiologically, for action. Terror is an extreme form of fear that can occur when an unexpected and frightful stimulus is presented. So, but in Buddhist psychology, including this sutra, fear and terror are listed as 2 different tendencies, given their role, I guess. But they come from the same root, but they are, in terms of action, their roles, they are listed as 2 different tendencies, inner mental tendencies. Fear is, again, when you, it's a feeling. You feel that something going to happen soon, and then you ready your body. So that you sense some fear. It's more like a feeling. When it comes to terror, you actually go through something. Your body goes through fear more than your mind does. So that's the difference between fear and terror. Once again, if I read that out, fear is the feeling that a person experiences when a threat is sensed. So it's still on the level of sensing. Whereas you feel like something going to happen. Then the role of fear is fear readies the body, both psychologically and physiologically, for action.
When is that definition the one you're reading out, in English one?
English one, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I compared with the Pali one also. And there are so many definitions, but also because as we use English terms,
yeah,
we have to choose the correct one. Because there's a slight difference between fear and terror in Buddhism too.
Yes, I just thought that the English definition, not to my surprise, was a very good one, because, you know, I could watch the news and see that a country is under threat and then not develop fear, because it's about me.
Exactly.
So surely it's about me. Maybe, obviously, the English definition doesn't consider
this. Yeah, right. One more example is, now, you are watching a horror movie. And so when you start watching the horror movie, and for sure you know that it is a movie. So, now, then you hear someone knocking on your door. So So,
so
that is, that's still fear.
Yes.
Now that's the second level of fear. There's a fine line between fear and terror, according to the sutras also. Then all of a sudden, you see, how to say, now, front door is partially facing a wall, and you see a black cat sitting there. And then, because when the light is reflected in the cat's eyes, and you see it's like blinking. And then what happens? In case you get shaken, your body gets shaken, that is terror then. That is terror, yeah.
But if you react really badly to knocking on the door, you know, if you just freak out,
yeah, that's,
is that also terror?
It's also a subtle, lower level of terror. However, if you feel that in your body, because when you feel only psychologically, it's very difficult for you to see the difference between fear and terror. So that's why Buddha, according to the sutra, the body is involved.
Wow.
Like you are sweating, shivering. So at least the slightest, the simplest thing that could happen is that when you, as you are watching the horror movie, now, and at the same time you hear a sound outside your house, and then at least you just turn back and see. So quick, it happens so quick. If you just slowly turn around and see, it's like a fear, the feeling only. You are simply sensing. In case you turn around quick, so quick, that it happens like a snap. And that is the beginning of terror. And another, the other thing is, fear and terror are, in Buddhist psychology, tendencies are processes. It's not something that happens quickly. It's a whole, fear is a process. Terror is a process. So that is why it's very difficult to see the fine line between fear and terror. So unless the body, so that's when it says where we are ready psychologically. The readiness of your mind and body to face anything. And some people have fear. When you have fear, you are still confident that you can deal with whatever in case something happens. But actually, when something actually happens, that's when you run away. And again, I don't actually agree even though it's the best English translation, I don't, as you said, I don't really agree to this definition, because what the Pali definition is way more deeper, it's way deeper than the translation. But I just want to start up by saying, referring to this general definition, general difference of fear and terror.
It's all about yourself, even if you're scared for someone else, it's because maybe you're attached to them, but it has to be about the threat is to you, or to
right.
someone connected to you.
To, exactly.
Self-centered,
yeah.
Yes.
Connected to you. Otherwise, it's just, for example, and then war also, when you talk about wars, battles, and things, you know, sometimes we feel some fear. Fear is closer to our theoretical understanding, whereas terror is much closer to our actual experience. Now, the war between Palestine and not Palestine, actually between Israel and Palestine, Hamas. Now, so. Among us, there could be, would disregard it, or some of us would feel. Now, we couldn't have intense feelings as though it's our own experience, but however, it's not terror yet. But if you're caught up in the war, you are in Israel or in Palestine, and you actually experience it, that is really terror then. as you say, it's all, as long as it's not connected to you, it's not fear or terror. Definitely, it's related to you. It comes to, it's connected to you.
And so, if somebody, for example, who has returned from war, and if they're suffering from PTSD,
exactly, that's perfect. Because I work with the PTSD veterans in the U.S. I'm affiliated with the Veterans Affairs Department, PTSD. Now, their fear is deeply rooted. But actually what you experience all of a sudden is a terror.
Sudden terror.
That's PTSD's terror. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up, yeah, terror. That's, that could be the best example for this, yeah. PTSD.
If I'm walking and if I feel like someone is following behind me, I suddenly saw it.
Yeah.
So it is fear or terror?
That's fear. That's fear. In case the person walking behind you get much closer to you.
There is no one around, I know there's no one, but I can feel the sounds different.
First you don't feel anything, you are just walking down, strolling down the street after work, maybe it's a ravine or a sidewalk, you don't feel anything. All of a sudden you feel like somebody is walking behind you, and then first, you feel fear, but soon it becomes terror. In case it goes back to fear, in case that person now doesn't get much closer, but somehow he's on the phone, so that's when you sometimes, when you turn around and see, because no, you are not the target, he's not following you. But still, fear would... there can be a glimpse of fear in your mind, because what happens is you replay your experience. So it's not terror, and all of a sudden, see people cry, people scream. Yeah, some people scream all of a sudden. Why? Even though there was no one around, there's no criminal, nobody's going to get you. However, it could be both actual or psychological. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sometimes it is based on your prior experience. Because you encountered, you were in a similar situation before. At that point, it's directly a tendency of terror, not fear. Mm-hmm, yeah. Uh-huh. Like they are chronic fears.
Phobia.
Chronic, yeah. Phobias, yeah. Now, they are also listed, now, Buddha always, especially in Abhidharma, there's a set of twin tendencies of the mind. Now, we will have a different discussion on that. Fear, for example, for now, they are not actual terms. I'm just touching on that. Now, fear of the body, fear of the mind, excitement of the body, excitement of the mind. There are called body-mind tendencies. So always, body is involved in now, even in Buddhist psychology, it's always, even though it's called psychology, it's not only about our mind. Always, Buddha talks about body tendencies as well. Psycho tendencies and body tendencies, both. For example, one thing is raga. When some people have some intense sexual feelings, so that it involves more, it's more physiological than psychological. So they are called bio tendencies. One day we'll have a discussion, and then so when it comes to chronic fear, like panic attacks, phobias, such chronic fears or terrors involve biological conditions. So because I work with some autistic children. I know one child, he is autistic. It had nothing to do with the genetics. During the delivery, nurses pulled when the mother was delivering her, a nurse, due to medical error, I think a blunder. So it was a natural delivery. However, the nurse at service, she pulled the baby a little harder. As a result, he got some autistic condition. So there are different kinds of autism too. Some are genetic. Some are due to medical errors and all these things. So now, when fear or terror or any tendency involves body, so there's a different definition of that in Buddhist psychology in the sutras. So because it requires more attention and more descriptions, chronic fears. Because some people have fear and terror, they are purely genetic, not psychological. Sometimes I know some genetically inherited fears. I know one mother in Texas. She comes from a drug addict family. Every family member is a heavy smoker. And she continued to smoke during her pregnancy as well. Now, her son has always wheeze, breathing difficulty, short of breath, something. And doctor says it's a genetic condition due to mother's behavior. Now, and Buddha talks about that too. Certain fears are. So, but in general here, psychological and physiological. Could be physiologically oriented fear and terror, and psychologically oriented fear and terror, and then both.
Mind and body.
Yeah, mind and body both involved, yeah. So.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Does the Buddha ever refer to what is now called epigenetic conditions in which the genetic genetic inheritance doesn't express itself,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And maybe never expresses itself. It can be triggered by something.
That's right. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. They are called anusaya roga, meaning dormant illnesses, dormant health conditions. So they when triggered, they get activated, and then you go through that. Yeah.
Or you don't get.
Exactly. We call that nidhana. Nidhana literally means like a treasure trove, like a treasure hidden in the ground, in the cave. Nidhana. Buried. Buried treasure. Treasure buried and belonging to probably ancient king. So the same way, we have certain nidhanas or root causes. That's a possibility. It's more like we were all born with oncocells. Cancer cells, cancer cells. Given the opportunity, they can start killing us, oncocells. So we were born with the possibility of any illness, any sickness. As you said, when triggered, that can even generate new illnesses, new sicknesses. New illnesses are in play. You people that know that. But they need to get conditioned into environmental conditions. See, like decades ago, we never heard about AIDS and Ebola and very dangerous STD and all these things. But now there are new kinds of things. What happens to you? See. Different coronavirus variants, sub-variants. And nowadays people get flu, and any flu that nowadays we get anywhere in the world, when it comes to symptoms, the symptoms are similar to coronavirus symptoms. Before that, like 10 years ago, we didn't have that many varieties, different kinds of flu. But there are so many variants, but all those variants look so similar in symptoms. Sometimes we find it difficult to identify the symptoms. So what Buddha talks about is our body is vulnerable to any illness. That's how the phrase goes. Our body remains vulnerable, our mind-body remains vulnerable to any illness. That's the general definition. So given the opportunity, elsewhere, especially Girimananda Sutta, and in Patijasamupada Sutta, Girimananda Sutta, Buddha, you can come across a whole list of root causes of illness, different kinds of karma-oriented, misbehavior-oriented illnesses, karma-oriented illnesses, environmentally oriented illnesses, food-oriented, thought or emotion-oriented illnesses. There are different kinds of illnesses.
Is a karma-oriented illness one that just can't be explained?
Yeah, karma-oriented, karma vipakaja, because certain illnesses we inherit from our past, due to our past life karma, past karma. That's called karma vipakaja. And there are certain illnesses for which there's no cure. Even though it looks like curable, but there's no remedy. Sometimes people make up their mind, maybe this is a karmic disease, something. And in sutras, it's one certain kind of type of illness, according to Girimananda Sutta, karma vipakaja. We'll have a different discussion on that. Utuparinamaja, due to seasons, like cold, due to cold weather, heat waves, cold waves. That's due to climate conditions. And visama pariharaja, meaning your behavior is not good. You eat whatever, you don't know how to eat. You don't eat healthy food. You don't know how to drink. You don't know how to maintain your health. That's called visama pari. Visama means improper. Pariharaja means consumption. You consume improper things. When it comes to consumption of unhealthy thoughts, unhealthy feelings. Unhealthy feelings can make you sick. Unhealthy food can make you sick. So there are different kinds of reasons for illnesses. One day we have a whole discussion on that. Now, always, most of the time, most sutras, in studying most sutras, you also need to understand the cultural and the cultural background to those sutras. Now, as we said, discussed last week also, purity. Purification is one big, religious, not a concept, one big concern when it comes to spiritual practice in mainstream Indian religions. Now here, when you look at point number two, remote forest paths and forest dwelling are actual places where fear and terror are possible, as well as, number two, metaphorical of the inner fear and inner terror. Buddhist sutras use the analogy of forest. Now, there are two kinds of forest, actual physical forest and metaphorical forest. Now, for example, when you are a forest dweller, and elsewhere Buddha explained when he was a bodhisattva, how he went through fear and terror. He was not enlightened yet. In the middle of the night, he would wake up in terror to a wildlife screaming, and then he would feel, he would first sense the presence of wildlife, predator animals. So he would feel fear. And then when he hears the wildlife approaching, then it's not fear anymore, it's terror. And he gave a very fascinating narrative of how he encountered. See, now, some people believe that if a bodhisattva, you know, in certain Buddhist denominations, bodhisattvas are cosmic and they are all in, and then they are waiting for their enlightenment, they have completed all their, but that's according to Pali Sutras, it's not, you could be a bodhisattva. As long as you are not enlightened, you are vulnerable to fear and terror. So forest is used as an analogy to explain fear and terror. Now, but in this sutra, Buddha explains how he actually encountered fear and terror as a forest dweller when he, during his bodhisattva practice. The sutra talks about two kinds of spiritual people in terms of their vulnerability to fear and terror. Now, this is the key point here. That's what we already touched on. Buddha, Abhisambuddha, is not vulnerable. Unawakened bodhisattvas are vulnerable. The latter includes anybody on the path of practice, including monks, priests, samana, and brahmins, priestly caste, anyone. Now, bodhisattvas. The point here is, Buddha doesn't have fear and terror. Why is that? In our day-to-day life, I mean, just forget about the sutra. The rise of fear and terror is based on our attachments or expectations. Attachments. Because when we set goals, and up until we have achieved our goals, our targets, we feel uneasy, we feel shaky. We always have second thoughts. So that's very common when it comes to unenlightened ones. Now, upon your enlightenment, you don't have any expectations. You don't anticipate achieving nothing there. You have no attachment, because attachments are due to expectations. We attach to something in expectation of experiencing and making ourselves happy, gratifying us, ourselves. Now, enlightened people, they don't expect anything. If you want to I did some of these experimental things with youngsters sometimes. I would support boys and girls in schools in America, first year university. So I would collect four girls, like a bunch of handsome boys pictures, for boys, handsome girls, pretty girls, and for handsome boys, four girls. Sometimes I would just put on a bigger screen and run one by one in a PowerPoint. There are about 25 girls, which one you need? And I bring all the pictures onto the same screen at the same time. Then first I run them, like in slides. Then I ask them, well, I don't know which one. Then I do is I make them bigger one by one. Now that's when, it's experiment. I have their permission though first. It's like an experiment, psychological experiment. And then I ask them to, and later on, a few minutes later, and then I would have numbered them. 1, 2, 3, 1 to 24, 1 to 25. And then he would say, specific boy that I asked the question, and he would say, I like number 3 and 23. But you can't have two. Could you just play 3 and number 23 again? Okay. Well, I think I want 23. And then after the experiment, and they would approach me, do you actually know that girl? So those are little experiments of attachment. But the first time I had the slides running on the screen, and then the boy, and he didn't care, because there are too many. When there are too many, when you see, look at someone on the bus, on the train, on the tube, in a shopping place, somewhere, when you see someone, but you don't care because there are too many people, too many things. However, when you take a second look, when you look back and see the second time, the third time, and you create more sankharas, one day we'll talk about sankharas, so create imprints. Once created one imprint, and you keep, you actualize, you bring that one imprint into life again and again. So we only need to create an imprint only once.
Is that the development of craving?
Exactly, yeah.
Well?
That's the craving, yeah.
Exactly,
that's how, because craving, Pali word for craving is tanha, T-A-N-H-A, tanha, or the T-R-U-S-H-A, trushna. Tanha or trushna literally means thirst. Thirst. So that you go tanha. So the Buddhist term is fascinating. You are always thirsty of something. Your mind is thirsty, your body is thirsty. We are thirsty of something all the time. We need to consume, we need to try something. That's craving, tanha, trushna, thirst. Now, thirst never ends. There's no limit to our thirst. Right. You experience something, you are happy for the moment, and you need it. Unless you get it again, you will feel unhappy. Yeah, that's what keep craving, that generates, that activates craving, trushna, tanha, thirst, and so that it could be, there are some people, they only look for only one or two things all their life. That's the only thing that they need. Some people only need only one thing in their life. They don't need many things. But sometimes they suffer more than those who need many more things in their life. Because when you are too much after one particular thing, you might get obsessed with that. So the Buddhist, so this, how our tendencies work is very complex, in a very complicated way. Now the Bodhisattva. Fear factor and terror factor are mentally derived due to mental impurities, verbal impurities, impurities in, now number C is very important here, impurities in livelihood. So mental, verbal, what about the physical impurity here? There's no such thing here in the sutra. Whereas, as opposed to a widespread belief that you can wash off your sins by taking a few dips in the Ganges that we explain, See the difference here? Buddha doesn't talk about physical impurity here. Why? It doesn't have to. Physical impurity doesn't have to do anything with our spiritual practice here. Whereas in his society, it did. See, that's why verbal, mental impurity is aparisuddha, the manokamma. Well, when your mind have negative feelings, of course it affects your health. Sometimes it can arouse fear and terror, mental impurity. Especially I notice when I work with children, when I discuss their dreams. People say, monster dreams, they say. A monster came in my dreams and he tried to swallow me. So then I ask them most of the time, because during the day someone, they got bullied in school. Especially it happens during the first few weeks of their life in school. Like monster dreams, they said. So that what happens is this, now there is fear in the child's mind. So it's fear is a mental impurity. So not fear, it's a negative feeling. Any negative feeling is considered an impurity. It's an impurity of the mind. Anything negative, because you lose your balance. Like jealousy, ill will, that your dress is, someone else's dress is way more attractive and way more expensive, so that you feel uneasy. You create that problem for yourself. The other party wouldn't even look at that. See, that's when, because this refers back to the very first verse in the Dhammapada. Mind is forerun by the mind. Mind is the forerunner. Both in purity, mental purity and mental impurity. There are two words, verse number one and two. Verse number one is about mental impurity. Verse number two is mental purity. So if your words are pure, if your actions are pure, you don't have to worry about. Why? Because you haven't done anything wrong. But some people don't do any harm to anyone socially. But however, they still suffer because due to their mental impurity, negative feelings. I know I have met the best and the most spiritual, virtuous people in my life. I met. They are perfect. However, they still have problems. Why? They haven't done any harm to anyone, not to themselves, not anything self-harming. However, they have some mental. They are shaky, because their minds, either because sometimes innocence too. You can fall victim to your own innocence to some people. Honesty. That is why Buddha recommends that when it comes to the practice of one of the nine Buddha qualities, vijjācārana, when you are you need to maintain coherence between vijjā, brain, and chārana, heart. Brain-heart coherence is one of the hardest and Buddha qualities. So that quality we widely use in business studies and in marketing psychology, corporate psychology, and all these things, especially vijjācārana. In our day-to-day lives, sometimes your heart is pure. You haven't done anything wrong. However, you have some negative feelings because you feel guilty for no reason. I have met lots of people who feel guilty for no reason. Well, for example, they've been helping a lot of people financially, emotionally, with the knowledge, professional knowledge they have. When they miss one appointment with someone, and they suffer a lot, they say, okay, I couldn't help that party. How many times? Okay, well, for the last 3 years I've been teaching them. But you only miss it once, right? But you know what? But the thing is, I never wanted to miss. It's my teaching session for him. So, and that is when Buddha recommends that. Don't feel guilty. I know lots of people, a lot of meditators too, they feel guilty. They haven't done anything wrong for others. They haven't done anything wrong for themselves. So that is when we need to see, and that is when Buddha says reasoning is very important.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
What about the development of courage? And somebody said to me, there's two kinds of people. I think it's actually a Russian saying that potatoes and eggs, and when you boil a potato, it goes all soft and that's what when you boil an egg, it goes tough.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the Buddha has to say about the development of
courage.
Courage.
Mm-hmm. when it comes to courage, what he says is that only two things. Ethical boundaries and also legal boundaries too, courage. Now, for example, when there's fight between two criminals, right? Whosoever kills the other one wins. There's no ethics involved. Whereas in a boxing match or something, so there are rules, you have to adhere to rules and regulation, there are criteria, timing and all these things. See, so courage, in developing courage, one key thing that we need to be watchful is our ethical responsibility. As a result of your ethical consideration, sometimes you may slow down in developing your courage. But even though it's a slow mode, but it is good. So, now that is why it takes a bodhisattva many millions of lifetimes or eons or kalpas to develop the qualifications, to complete the qualifications for Buddhahood, for his enlightenment. Think about a lot of things, especially ethical considerations.
He had courage.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't worried
mm-hmm.
about the tiger coming to bite his leg off.
Yeah, that's right. Because the thing is, he didn't have... Now, a bodhisattva is not supposed to have attachment even to his own body. Because finally, the final goal is to become totally selfless.
That's the ego.
Ego, yeah. That's the ego, yeah. So... So then, you can run away. Bodhisattvas don't run away from a tiger. And they would stand still. Now, somebody might think that he should live longer so that he can save the world and help the world, and so that he could practice more if he. But a bodhisattva wouldn't think like that. Now, then he would consider any dangerous opportunity, any situation, he would consider as yet another opportunity for practice. When I had the same question from my mother when I was a child, my mother, I used to go to bed with my mother. All my elder siblings would go to bed early. But I always asked my mother to tell me a story. And most of the time, I was very curious about Bodhisattva path. I asked him, why did Bodhisattva go through so much of suffering to become the Buddha? When she told me the Jataka stories, birth stories of the Buddha, son is a wrong question. Why wrong? Because there's no suffering in the Bodhisattva's life. To you, it is suffering. It is suffering to me. I consider it suffering. But to a bodhisattva, there's no suffering. Any situation, however negative, however dreadful it is, would be another opportunity for him to practice, test himself, practice himself, and practice his path. There's no ego whatsoever then. Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking, you often hear the example of mistaking a rope for a snake
mm-hmm. yeah.
as a way of communicating
right.
how your mind can play tricks.
That's right. Mm-hmm. I screamed twice in my childhood due to that. After school, there's no one.
Was it a rope or a snake?
Yeah, so it was a rope.
A rope
and it had fallen from the attic. So that I screamed and then I shivered. I almost passed out. But actually, the next time... the next day morning, I saw a small, very skinny rat snake inside the kitchen. But it took me for some time to arouse my fear. Why? I thought it was a rope.
So it can work both ways?
Yeah, play, yeah.
So what I'm thinking is, mm-hmm. for a bodhisattva,
yeah.
even if it's a snake,
mm.
they... Because they've got no sort of mental
great,
attachment
yes.
or formation.
Formation, exactly.
Snake,
that's right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Fear arises.
Yeah, fear arises. It's like I have, my mother came over and she convinced me that it was a piece of rope.
Mm-hmm.
But to a bodhisattva, it would be right from the beginning,
yeah.
It would be like it was a piece of rope.
Right.
As you said, there's no formation, no sankharas created out of that.
Mm-hmm.
There's no fear factor there.
Is the, when it talks about forest dwelling, because I'm thinking of the things that we are afraid of, is there a difference between a fear of the known and a fear of the unknown?
Yes.
Because it often feels as though
at
the heart of all fear is a fear of the unknown, that what's going to happen to me?
Right,
yeah. What's going to happen if...
Fear of the unknown is more dangerous. I mean, that's that more adversely affect us. Fear of the unknown. So that is when it's a military strategy too, military tactics too. They don't attack enemies, but the military want to know, locate the enemy. When they locate the enemy, so that they can plan the ambush. As long as you don't know where your enemies are, that's the fear of the unknown. When,
like that book, Out of War, Lao Tzu.
That's right, yeah.
Which is all based on being very cunning.
Very cunning, yeah. That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm, cunning, yeah. So, and not only a bodhisattva, according to one sutra in the Samyutta Nikaya, in Devata Samyutta, one day, late at night, there was this Devata. This divine being come into Buddha when Buddha was living in the forest, and he came to him and see that he said that even though I am a divine being, during the day in the hot summer, when the sun is hot, I hear the wildlife screaming in thirst, they are starving. So when I hear the sounds, I feel lots of fear. And Buddha would explain to him. So then, and that sutra is a very important sutra when it comes to even divine beings. They are not enlightened, they have fear too. But however, they are more like forest dwelling, like earthbound spirits, earthbound devatas, deities, not the deities from higher heavens. So there are different kinds of. When Buddhist people share merit, they say, Akasatta Jabhummatta, I share my merits with earthbound terrestrial devas and celestial devas. Because when it comes to different levels of happiness, heavenly happiness, it depends on how high the heaven is. Yeah. The higher it is, you have more comfort. It's like one child asked me in America, is it Bhante, it's because that you are completely off the gravity? I said, yes, we are off the gravity of dukkha. Actually, he wrote a very nice lesson on gravity of dukkha. He said that one day he wants to go to NASA. And at the same time, he said, I want to go to NASA, I want to be a scientist. At the same time, I also need to be a psychologist. Two different things. So, and to him, off the gravity. But I like that term. Then I explain, so in respect to him, then I redefine the term gravity. Then he wrote a lesson, gravity of dukkha. You feel heavy and you feel being pulled down. Pulled down. That's what he meant by gravity. Actually, we do feel that. So that according to that, Devata, he felt fear. He had fear. And he explained, and Buddha explains that, and Buddha said that without referring to whether it's a divine being or a human being, and Buddha used the same dichotomy, enlightened and unenlightened. So regardless of your status, like a divine being or a human being, and Buddha said that, as long as you are not enlightened, Devata, you will remain in fear. Fear can pop up and so distract you any time. So it doesn't matter whether you are a divine being or a human being. So that's why we call that, I think, did I explain that this, geometrically speaking, you draw a circle, and then you know the radius, and then so you draw this horizontal line, and above the line are enlightened ones, divine beings, human beings, and below the line are unenlightened human beings and divine beings. It doesn't matter if someone is divine or human. What matters is enlightenment or enlightened or not enlightened yet.
I'm just realizing this question might be too broad, but I'm wondering if the Buddha ever spoke about subconsciousness things like instinct. We often talk about human nature, but what about sort of instinctive behavior, which almost feels as though in those moments it's kind of overriding any mental activity.
Right,
it
feels
spontaneous.
Some of the, Buddha talks about 52 tendencies of the mind. Some tendencies are instincts, actually.
Right.
Yeah, built-in instincts. So, as human beings, we always act on our experience and instincts. Animals, mostly, they act on their instincts, natural instincts. Now, for example, most wildlife, I mean domesticated ones, they love children. Right? We do too, human beings. And so now you have seen that, those wildlife videos, sometimes tigress have motherly instincts when she killed a baboon, and the baboon was delivering the baby. And that's the moment that the tigers attacked. And then, so instead of consuming the carcass of the mother baboon, and she started licking and taking care of the baboon baby. But at least for the moment, she got motherly instincts. But later on, she might eat, or the pack of members from her pack would come over and eat. So, instincts are basically, Buddha talks about instincts and natural instincts and tendencies. So that's why there are differences of opinion as to those 52 chetasikas. Are they instincts, whether they are instincts or tendencies? Most of them are instincts actually, built-in instincts. We act on them. For example, raga is an instinct. There are different opinions as to whether they are instincts or tendencies. But a tendency, it is an instinct that becomes a tendency.
So it's a combination.
Combination.
Some of the underlying tendencies that we looked at last week.
Right, anusaya, the seven.
Wouldn't they be like subconscious fears as well, for example? Was there a pratika one, wasn't there?
A pratika. Patika is subtle anger. It comes from fear. Patika. You get angry means out of fear actually. That you are angry means you fear someone. You are angry with someone means you fear that person. You fear them. That's why when they come, you never want to face them and you walk away. I know, if they come, I wouldn't come to your party. No. Please.
Is that because you're threatened by them?
Yeah, you are threatened by them. You are threatened by their presence.
You're threatened by them or threatened by your reaction?
Your own reaction too, yeah. Mm-hmm. It could be like mind-made or maybe based on the situation involving another party. I know some people are always angry. They have patika, even if they live by themselves. Why? They can handle, they can afford, they can manage their things. Sometimes some people offer to help you, but you get angry when they offer. Why? You will say, you even become, very aggressive too. I don't need your help.
I can manage,
yeah. And then you suffer a lot.
Yes.
You suffer and you cry even. So you lock up, when they are gone, you lock the door and then you cry. And take a deep breath again. No, I gotta get through this. So.
There's a big connection between anger and fear. Actually, I've noticed a few times when when somebody's been really angry with me, it's a disguise because they don't want me to ask certain questions.
Mm-hmm.
They're afraid that I'm going to ask some questions and put them on the spot, so therefore they get really aggressive and angry as a defense mechanism.
Defense mechanism, right, yeah. That's right, yeah.
You can always use metta, karuna, upekkha practice in the moment.
Yeah.
Against fear. Works for me.
Yeah. That's why when it comes to practice the four divine abodes, four divine abidings, metta, unconditional love, loving kindness, karuna, compassion, mudita, altruism, or being happy with other people's achievements, and upekkha, mental balance, emotional balance, equanimity. So because it's very hard, and Buddha recommend that we consider those four as directions, or you radiate those four things in the different directions, so that you don't practice that for a specific people. Unknown people first, because when you try to practice for those four things, how could I radiate metta to him and he is the one who victimized me, and he borrowed lots of money and he is yet to return my money. So how could I do metta to him?
It doesn't matter.
So the thing is, then when you practice generally and every direction, when my metta, karuna, mudita, and upekkha goes in the eastern direction, whosoever they may benefit from my metta, karuna, mudita, and upekkha. Western, eastern, northern, nadir, zenith, 10 direction, behind me, before me, on my sides, up, below me, above me. So when you get used to that, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whom you give your metta. So that is when in practice also Buddha recommends that don't rush to do metta to enemies or the people who would always antagonize you. Don't rush to do metta. Why? You might end up enhancing your patika, your anger, instead of metta.
More work in a war.
Exactly. Yeah, true. And also don't do that for the dead people. So metta is for a healthy relation with living people, for living, yeah. So, yeah, not for the dead. You can have karuna though, compassion, not metta.
But Bhante, right? When someone has died, they are a living being in another life now.
Yeah. Or that way you can do that.
Yeah.
As long as you don't invite feelings of sadness due to their demise, you are okay. Okay. But most people don't have the understanding that you do. So that's what they fall. They fall from their metta.
Is that because it reinforces attachment?
Exactly.
Is that the same for fictionalized characters?
Yeah.
Well, you know, because when you watch a movie, the whole thing is meant to be emotionally involved with it, or a book or something too. What's the definition of metta in this? I think I know what it is, but I'm going to clarify that.
Yeah, unconditional. We have affection with people, but that is unconditional love.
Wanting them to be happy? Really?
Yeah, happy.
Passions want to take away their pain?
Yeah, pain, yeah. Even if your enemy or opponent hurts you, but you don't, you disconnect yourself in terms of fear. But still, emotionally, you can remain connected with that party because you have sympathy. Empathy would be very difficult for you at the beginning. Empathize, but sympathize, sympathy can be. Because sympathy is a savior at that point, because most people don't like your sympathy. However, when it comes to dealing with your opponents and enemies, it's not empathy, because you cannot get any closer. But in sympathy, because you always feel sympathy because they are in trouble, so I can't do anything. You feel sorry for them, that's sympathy then. in case you go forward and you take some drastic steps and go forward and talk to them, invite them for a discussion or dialogue, and you ask them why you hate me. And that is the first step of empathy then. So that is when putting your metta into action. Most of the time, metta, it takes time. There's a warning sign against rushing to do metta to your opponents. You might end up justifying your non-metta to them. And have faith through, say, no, I'm not supposed to, because I've gone through all this trouble for the last 20 years since my life because of him or her or because of them. Why should I, how could I do metta? They don't deserve my kindness. Mm-hmm. That's what people say, they don't deserve.
But the Buddha never talks about that.
Buddha never talks about that.
Deserving
so,
or not.
Exactly. So that's when Buddha gives a warning sign. May my enemies, ceremoniously you could say, may my enemies be well, happy and peaceful. You can put some rhyme into that and say, may my enemies be well, happy and peaceful. But actually, then when you open your eyes, your enemy is standing right there. No, not again. Okay, so that's a different thing then. So that's why it's always, if you feel uneasy, when you try to do metta to someone that you dislike, whose presence brings you some uneasiness, and don't rush to do metta, skip that step. Skip and you can come back to later, work on others, because sometimes you need to do metta to yourself first. In that case, you feel uneasy in doing metta to your enemy, come back to yourself and do re-energize yourself. I think I am much weaker before him. I need to strengthen myself. So that's when it takes much time. You have to go back to yourself. Forget about other steps, because you can deal with the other steps very easily, your parents, loved ones, co-workers, teachers, anyone. People indifferent to you, people that you meet in day-to-day life. But however, when you do metta to enemies or opponents, when you begin to feel uneasy, come back to yourself as soon as possible and say, I think I need to do a metta to myself because I'm losing my energy because of that party. So always come back, run back to yourself. Don't get any closer to enemy for metta. I mean, in your feelings. The third part, so the fear factor, mental fear factor and terror factor are mentally derived due to mental impurities, is clear. Verbal impurity, that's speech, actually. But the point here is impurities in livelihood, not physical impurities here. Mm. Not body, a paradigm shift in the Indian attitude towards female body and belief that bodily purity leads to emancipation. Most of the time, in lots of cultures, female body is considered impure. Because that is why I kind of became an... people call me a feminist, actually. I attended lots of protest by activists. Because once I had to do Malaysia. I was visiting Malaysia a whole month. Indonesia. Indonesian maids were constant. They are rape victims in certain Middle Eastern countries. I'm not, because this is a public forum, and I'm going to name countries. So there's domestic workers. And some of my, and also in America also, one of my friends from India, when he raped a girl, and the girl belongs to a lower caste, then I asked him, when you raped the girl, didn't you think about that she is low caste? Yeah, he's a member of a meditation group, not my best friend. We call the in that language, we call them friends, not friends' friends. Yeah, so it's a circle. Then so that he went to jail. Now he came to me and asked for a character certificate. I said, no, I wouldn't be able to write that because my conscience doesn't help you to permit you to write a testimonial for you. Because then one big question I asked him, I visited him in jail. Now, you belong to a higher caste, and the girl is low caste, and this is the girl that she was brought from India as a domestic worker. So you always condemned her. But at night, you sneak into her room. How many times? 15 times. You raped her. So every time you did, didn't you feel that I'm raping a low caste, I'm not supposed to touch her? And he cried. Then I said, this is time. It's not theoretical, actually. Spirituality is something practical. So now, in that process in Malaysia, they were protesting in front of the Saudi Arabian embassy there. A lot of girls came back. They were rape victims, some with carrying babies. That was the problem. Because I was also invited to give a little talk. There were different people, different religions. Now, because it was done in English, because even though I was a visiting monk there, and there were some Indonesian monks, how they couldn't speak in English. So I gave a talk, like 5 minutes, I said that. I had to think about religion also, there were some Saudi officials standing there. I said that you talk about different denominations within your religion, and some people are sinners because they don't belong to your religion. But by the time, why did you rape sinners then? Why did you rape sinners? What happens to your dignity and all these things? So now, overall, not only in India, but also in different countries, some female body is condemned. You know, it happens, sometimes some girls are born, right? It happens in India, China. Yeah. They secretly kill, murder baby girls. If it's a female child, they kill. They don't want them to grow up. However, the men who kill, actually they were also born out of the mother, born from the mother's womb, a female body. Mother's womb. So overall, that's now Buddha excluded completely that men, that bodily impurity has nothing to do with spirituality. So instead, Buddha said, it is livelihood. And Buddha said that even if a king loots people's, so the property of his subject citizens, at that point, now he is impure in his livelihood. Now, and that is when Buddha said, nobody is, by birth, no one is noble or noble or low caste, untouchable. By action, one becomes noble or outcast. And that corresponds to this one, impurity in livelihood, the way you live, the way you make a living. That's what matters, actually, not the bodily impurity. So the bodily impurity has nothing to do with... So that's when Buddha had lots of debates with lots of people who came to argue with the Buddha. And that's when, as we just referred last week, I see, and when he told someone, a Brahmin visiting him, that if you claim that purification of body leads to salvation, can I say that... So the frogs and fish and all those are born in the water, they are automatically enlightened. They are enlightened by birth. They have achieved salvation. And the Brahmin felt uneasy and he walked away. So mental impurity. So, and the number 5 point is that's a list of... mental tendencies that they are more or less related to fear and terror. That's why this specific list. How many? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Excessive greed, ill will, sloth and torpor, drowsiness, restlessness or upheaval and unstillness, uncertainty, aggrandizing self, aggrandizing oneself or self-praise and despising or disparaging of others, panic and dread, desire for gains, offerings and fame, laziness and lack of persistence, unalert, unconcentrated, unpacified and stray-mindedness. Now, all these 11 tendencies, they are more or less related to fear and terror. There are more actually, but this specific list Buddha has given because you experience fear and terror when you encounter any of these tendencies.
Is that because they make you feel grounded when you engage in it?
Exactly, yeah.
You know, like, if you become a monk in this tradition, which I think a lot of people, I totally would feel scared.
Yeah.
Because, like, I'm losing, like, all the good things that I enjoy.
Right, yeah.
We talked a little bit about that on Tuesday, that we, when, you know, we equate all pleasure from desire.
Yes.
And so, to eradicate desire would eradicate all pleasure. Is is how it seems to come.
That's
across.
Right. Yeah.
Yes.
And that seems like something.
Buddha has declared two standards of pleasure seeking. Now, most of his teachings are specifically for monastics or those who are full-time on the path. For everyone else, he said, don't violate anyone else's rights and comfort for your own pleasure. Meaning, don't violate accepted legal and ethical boundaries for lay people and anyone else. Go enjoy. Oh, this is for myself. This is for a monk like myself. So that's what, there are two Buddha declared, the two levels of standard. Now, if you become a monk, then you don't even think about having a beer or going for a party or hanging around with your friends or anyone. But if I disrobe, then I wouldn't turn back and see the monastery because I said, bye-bye, I'm not in robe anymore. Then you might see me somewhere partying or... I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't leave the robe. I'm just saying. I mean, we switch our roles, our social roles. So that's when... It depends on the people. But this is for specifically for... But overall, this may help you to maintain your boundaries. Like, because they are harmful anyway.
Desire is not...
No, not a bad
skillful
thing.
Desires.
Yeah, yeah. What Buddha says is they are natural. It becomes good or bad based on the life that you live. For example, to me. Okay. For example, people, sometimes they go for what is called this new term, beer occasion. Right? So beer occasion, like vacation, it comes from vacation. Because I always play with English words, new English words. Like, you go vacation, you omit the vacation, vacation, you get off the vac, part of vac, and there's occasion, and you add beer, and beer occasion mean, it's not really vacation, you enjoy your beer as though you are in vacation, something. For example, the new terms. So, now you are partying yourself, you know, sometimes, especially in America, people say, when I call that, sipping a beer in the backyard when the sun is setting, when I, what are you doing? Okay, I'm partying. Meaning is enjoying yourself, right? So, and now, is it good or bad? It's not bad. It's natural. That's the way you enjoy. As you said, desires are neither good nor bad. They are natural. You need them. And even though I'm not supposed to say you need them. They are there, and you enjoy. You need to fulfill your desires.
Aware of that, how to enjoy, isn't it?
Yeah, but again, the only warning sign is the limits, boundaries. Now, I can go do that. Sometimes I made a friend for the first time when I went there, and he invited me to have a beer. I said no, I don't drink. you don't drink right now or never? I said, no, I never drink. Oh, sorry. Oh, but he said, don't say sorry. He said, I would drink some juice. But then he offered me orange juice. I spent the whole time, like 2 hours or so, sipping ice, sipping orange juice myself, and he said, and beers, beer. So there was nothing wrong with that. Sometimes in Canada, I go for Calgary Stampede rodeos. I get the rodeo seat, actually. I went there several times. Some my American cowboy friends, Buddhist, and they would buy me the best seat. Sometimes, one condition is that when you are seated among them, you need to pass the beers constantly. Okay. Enjoy. And there were some Sri Lankans with me there, and they were using the normal chairs, and they were watching that. And I know one of my Sri Lankan friends, and then he kept an eye on me. So that, then after the stampede, so that went to him then, and then I made sure, I said, sorry if I gave you neck pain. Why is that? Because you were looking, you wouldn't take your eyes off me, because you know what, given the situation. But didn't you feel uneasy because when you were passing the beer glasses? I said, no. Why? Because I understood the situation. And you, my friends purchased me the best seat. I was sitting there. Mm-hmm. And so that everyone was consuming beer. And so I didn't compare myself. I didn't even think that I am not drinking. In case I thought I am not drinking, and that's that feeling itself is unethical. It's as though that it would be better if I drink as well. So that's no such thing. I wouldn't even compare. I wouldn't even think about it. I just kept passing the beer. Okay. And once in a while, the second row, a few people on my left asked me, so you don't drink any beer? Are you a monk? Yes, I am. Yes, sir, I am. But you know, today is a special day. Your church wouldn't kick you out if you drink some beer. I said, no. Enjoy your beer. Okay. Actually, I made a lot more friends that day. They even asked me that question, whether I felt uneasy. I said, no. I wouldn't even think about it. So that's quite natural. That's the way they enjoyed. And the way I enjoyed is not drinking beer. They enjoyed drinking beer. And there was no problem with no beer or beer. That's self and no self, like.
It's reminding me, because fortunately, I didn't drink much alcohol anyway. Mm-hmm. And then ever since I've been coming here, I decided to stop completely. And I found it easy, because I never felt dependent on it. You asked me to give up chocolate biscuits, I'd have a harder time. But one thing I've noticed, like you say, when I've been in situations where normally it would almost be expected of me to drink.
Mm-hmm,
somebody
mm-hmm.
offers me a drink.
Right, yeah.
At that moment I say, no thank you.
Mm-hmm.
There is this weird atmosphere.
Yeah.
And often the person drinking will say something like, mm-hmm. oh, of course I don't normally. Right, you know, I'm just, you know, uh-huh. they almost feel like they have to be apologetic.
That's right, exactly.
And I feel like I have to say, it's okay.
Yeah.
When actually it was okay before any of that happened.
I perfectly understand your situation, because I have been through like 200 over times.
All the time.
And then when I refused to drink, and they became defensive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they came up with like a bunch of excuses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know what, I don't drink usually.
Yeah.
Today I drink.
So
that's ego, actually.
Yeah.
They're not supposed to...
I don't like to drink alone.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I
even made...
champagne, she said, I want to drink alone.
Uh-huh.
So I ordered two glasses of champagne, and half. I made her drink the other half.
Once
I
knew
she wanted it. But because of me, and I was treating her to a special dinner.
I made one enemy because of that, once in Singapore. Because I refused to drink, I would instead told him that, ask him for a glass of apple juice. Then I enjoyed that. Before I went back to my room, I was teaching that time, way back in 98. And he had called several people and said that so-and-so wanted to tell me that he's all virtuous and all these things and he's a good person. That's why he didn't drink. But I didn't, I asked them, okay, don't tell him that you called me and informed me. Actually, you were not supposed to tell me that. So that he felt so uneasy, he became angry, actually. He felt inferior to me. But you don't have to feel that way. Sometimes, you know, we feel uneasy. Because that's atmosphere changes all of a sudden, right?
You feel like... You're making a moral stance against them.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. Moral stance.
But then
mm-hmm.
they react because of the guilt and
Mm-hmm.
guilt, isn't it, really?
Mm-hmm.
I found a practical solution. It's just that they got all these non-alcoholic spirits out these days and nose echo instead of Prozac and stuff like that. And I've tried that stuff and I love it. It's brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get it, it's a different response. Because I've had that all my life, what you're saying as well. But now they're just so confused. They're like, you're drinking just gin on its own, but it's non-alcoholic. Like, yeah, but why have you got no alcohol in it? So, well, it tastes nice, and I get to join in with you. It just tastes nice. Like,
tastes nice.
There's no alcohol. They're like, so confused.
And it's something. I was with some friends on the weekend, and it happened again. I was offered in a much more intimate sort of setting. And his wife offered me a small glass of wine, and I just politely said, no, thank you. And again, she said that thing, I don't normally drink. And then she said, but a little bit relaxes your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I still don't really know what to make of that. Does it relax your mind? You know, when she said that, and I know that they've been having lots of marital troubles a lot, because my friend confides in me. And just that phrase, it relaxes your mind.
Relaxes your mind, yeah.
I'm not convinced it does, actually.
As an average human being, I have been in an awkward situation several times. When knowing that they're gonna have alcohol, I had to decide whether to attend that ceremony or not, event or not. If I skip that, then they would still feel that because we get drunk and he is not coming. And in case I went there, and then they would still feel like, okay, we drink and we get drunk and we drink, but he doesn't drink. And then what I do is, okay, I'm coming. Will you have some apple juice or orange juice? Because I love apple juice, then I would say. I mean, even if you offer me 10 glasses, I would still drink apple juice. Okay, if you like apple juice, we'll have a can full of apple juice and we homemade ones, and so that's why I just neutralize the situation sometimes.
Did that happen in the Buddha's time? Because I'm thinking, even what Jonathan said a moment ago, is that often guides a lot of the discussions, because in the same sort of way, the sutta is... it's communicating a message, and individually we've probably all got our thing that it kind of confronts, and inside we feel like, yeah, but it's okay because of this reason.
That's right, yeah.
Was that happening at the same time?
Yeah, at the same time.
Because it seems like a...
And that is called a struggle in Buddhism.
Right.
Struggle.
It feels like a struggle.
Yeah. Struggle, that's called favoring and opposing. I think we will have... In many times we happen to refer to that dichotomy, I mean those opposite feelings, loving and hating, anuruddha and pativiruddha, attachment and aversion, mania and phobia, loving and hating, getting inspired and inspiring and terrorizing. Terms explain the struggle, as Buddha says. Struggle is instantaneous and it only lasts a moment. So in Buddhism we don't talk about lifelong struggles. Struggle of the moment. sometimes the experience, when you get through that, when you deal with that within the moment, even if you encounter another millions of moments and you remain stable. But we need to test the moment, actually. Test ourselves given the moment. It's like a test.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
Actually thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know these mental tendencies?
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, the person's different stages of life,
mm-hmm.
you know, level of hormones,
yeah.
it can affect, doesn't
it? It does. Actually, by the way, we are not going to finish this one. Then next Thursday also we will continue the same sutra. There's so much to discuss. Yeah. Yes, it does.
You're recording it, aren't you, Bhante? Because I can't make next Thursday.
Hmm?
I can't make next Thursday. But
yeah, I will record and we can airdrop. You have an iPhone, right?
No.
Ah,
then we put it on the website. It's going
our website,
the website,
okay.
Well.
Yeah, later it'll go on the website.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, website.
Yeah.
So that's why I purposely took time to not to touch the tendencies here, because we need to discuss a lot of things here. And these, the list would put you on different directions. So then next week we will discuss these 11 tendencies specifically related to fear and terror. So any last questions? Any contribution? I mean, comments? I always like your comments.
I'm still struggling with 4B and C. I understand the explanation of the impurities and livelihood, but how does that relate to fear and terror?
Sorry, I didn't hear that. Wait a moment. I think the rails have to be, needs to be replaced. Mm-hmm. So.
It's all right, there's only two doors.
It'll be done in 1 minute. Yeah. So. Okay, so.
So you explained about the livelihood and purities, which is fine, but how does that manifest itself as interfering and terror factors?
Ah, okay, now this is way. Now you use your body, you use your physical body to make some harm to someone else, to harm yourself.
Oh, okay.
That's what it means ethically. So, for example, let's say you attack and kill someone. You are using your limbs, your hands. Or now the livelihood is a direct translation. Actually, it in layman's it should be instead of physical impurity that you use your body for how to say your body. Yeah, using your body. This is as opposed to the accepted in religious practice in India. When you regularly cleanse your body, and so it helps you achieve nirvana, salvation. So, and then what Buddha says is even if you live in the water, as long as you are not a good person, like you do harm, you harass others, you hit others, you kill others. So use your body to do any harm. So that's what in that means. Livelihood means actually living. Here, because Buddha wanted to include the position of physical body in this teaching. And to put the emphasis on the fact that bodily impurity has nothing to do with salvation. So somehow, Buddha wanted to include the role of the physical body in spirituality. So otherwise, the factor wouldn't be that important, because you understand in relation to the role of the physical body in spirituality in his time. Bodily impurity, when your body is impure. And so there are, you know, that's what are they called? Punyatirtha, right? Punyatirtha, designated bathing areas. Yeah.
Kumbh Mela.
Kumbh Mela and all these things. And there are designated rivers like the Ganges. Mm-hmm. Even other rivers also, there are designated to bathing areas. I know that in Varanasi.
Yeah.
Varanasi, I saw that high caste people bathe, and then so that just few feet down, low caste people. I approach the security guard and say, why not set up a bathing, why not designate a place for the low caste people down there, because there's no point talking about low caste, so I can't see it. And then he said that no, they were supposed to bathe in the dirty water.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's why the two bathing points are too close to each other. So that's one. Yeah, so that. Actually, when I spoke with the priest there, I met another priest from Ramakrishna. But he, Ramakrishna monk, and he was very liberal one. He said that he opposed that too. He opposes that. He's a different denomination. So. But it's very, they are fast disappearing in India, I know that, because younger generation, they don't care. They don't care which caste you belong to, which caste you are. Younger generation. And I noticed that because until I visited India and up until I met some people in India, I used to look at India in terms of the culture that existed in the 6th century BCE. When I went to India, that when I encountered that always priests, religious people are often targeted by young people, and they would always condemn, I don't like the way you preach. People would, they would dare say, I mean, younger generation. Straight away, yeah. Mm. It's a different India now.
Yeah.
It's a different
it's
India.
Very developed in a sense.
Exactly, yeah.
Generation.
Mm-hmm. Generation, yeah.
I think in rural areas it's so backward, though. Mm. So you hear stories of like little girls being kidnapped and abducted and raped and murdered.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Thank you for attending, and we will continue to discuss the same sutra next week, next Thursday.